think I have that one of that version also. No, I have. I'm talking about my personal library. I've had several versions of that. Well, I am tired to exhaustion, so I don't know how this is going to go tonight. pushing. We left off in the middle of Siegfried, just after Siegfried had slain the dragon. And when he had slain the dragon, he had driven his sword right into the heart of the matter. And as he licked off his sword blade, he was able to understand the language of the birds. And the bird told him that there were great treasures inside of the cave. The hoard of the dragon, the Tarnhelm, and the ring, which would give him power over the world. And as we finished last time, Siegfried had just gone into the cave. What happens then is Mima and Albrecht decide that they want to go in after Siegfried and be able to rob the gold, or at least get the ring or something like that. And they never actually get inside the cave, because they start fighting with each other, and they fight, they argue, each wanting the whole business and each feeling that they had the right to the whole business. And they argue so much that Siegfried already has done his business and he's coming out of the cave. Now, if Mima represents the lower nature in a personification, and Albrecht represents something like the Lucifer spirits or some sort of primal force of selfishness that influences us to our low or base type of behavior, this is exactly what we would expect. Because in the desire world, which is where that lower self resides, in the desire world, in the lower part of the desire world, there are the forces of repulsion. I think it works in such a way that the twin forces working in the desire world are attraction and repulsion. And love is the force of attraction. And the way it works is that if you give to people, people are drawn irresistibly to you, and everything works out with wonderful harmony. No, you know, even if there are problems, harmony eventually rolls its way through them. But in the lower part of the desire world, this is just like the cowboy movie, where the outlaws are going to rob the bank, and they do, and they get away successfully, and they're out in no man's land, or out in the bad lands somewhere, and there are four of them, and then they begin to think, well, if there were only three of us, we could divide that loot three ways. And the old statement that there is no honor among thieves applies very much to Mima and Albrecht. They can never accomplish what they want to accomplish because they're trying to pull things to themselves, and that repulses the other. And even though they're both after the same end and are trying to work together, they pull things apart. As they're arguing, Siegfried comes out of the cave, and they both sort of slink out. They go back into the forest and disappear, just as what you'd expect. Because if Siegfried represents the truth seeker and the light of truth, and he has now undergone the first part of initiation, facing the negative part of his being, if that's the case, then he is a creature that is filled with light, and that radiates and chases away the forces of darkness. And what happens is a most unusual thing. He's got the ring, and he's got the Tarnhelm. And the Tarnhelm, by the way, is, you know what the ring mail is? Something like chain mail, where they made out of metal these loops, and they loop them inside of each other. And the helmet is a helmet like that. The whole head is covered with an almost like fabric of steel so that nothing can pierce through it. And that's a really good description of what the vital body is like, because the vital body is what gives the power to apparently disappear or to take different shapes or such like that, that one can suggest light forms into the vital body, and people see the suggestions and they don't see the reality that is behind them. Apollonius of Tyana was known to disappear in before the emperor of Rome, where the emperor was saying he's going to do this and this and this to Apollonius, and Apollonius says you'll do nothing, and he just took his robe, which was also symbolic of the vital body, and covered himself and disappeared. But the chain mail is especially like the way the vital body is built, because the vital body is built by selfless deeds. Every time that we do something from the heart and completely unselfishly, what happens is we draw from the macrocosmic ethers, we draw more of the light ether especially, and we produce little spirals that work their way right into the etheric body, and they're momentarily, they're visible as a little spiral of light, just like the little spirals in the chainmail, or like the little rings in the chainmail, and then they become part of it. But Siegfried doesn't know what he really has at this point. And to a large extent, that's where we're at. We have a spiritual knowledge, but we have no knowledge, really. We don't have a grasp, or we don't have a vision of how powerful the faculties that we have within us, how powerful they really are. And Siegfried's in that same place. For him, they're just a couple baubles. You know, it's kind of neat that you can put on the Tarnhelm and do these things. And but he doesn't realize the great power for creation and for doing all the things in the cosmos that can be done. And so he's sitting there contemplating them. And while he's doing so, the bird comes back. And the bird warns him, let's see if I can find it here. The bird warns him, and says, he takes that same voice again, just like the intuition you'd expect the intuition to take. It takes that dispersonal, indirect tone of voice that we talked about last week. If Siegfried only listens carefully to the rogue's hypocritical speeches, he will be able to understand what Mima really intends in his heart. So at this point, the ability, this is a really critical time. He has overcome the tendency or the accumulation as a form externalized of all of his past evil. But he still hasn't completely slugged it out with his own lower nature. Now, more people become horrible black magicians and lost souls who falter at just this point. It isn't from somebody who is a thief or a petty criminal. That isn't where people are really recruited to ways of evil doing. It's people who are right on the edge of becoming divine that in the temptation and in the struggle from within overstep themselves, and then they take all the potential that they've accumulated and they turn it to the bad. But this is exactly where Siegfried is, but he now has the intuition awake, so he can not only hear the intuitive language of the bird, but he can actually see through what other people really intend. Because it's very easy to be fooled by people. You know, some people sound really good, but when it comes right down to it and you start looking through what they're saying, they just don't have it. and they're not really true. At the same time, Mima has come back, and he's beginning to contemplate how he should work with getting his way to get the ring from Siegfried. And he starts out with flattery. And because Siegfried knows himself, and he knows himself in a really clear way, all of the flattery sounds like excess. It's unnecessary words, and he can see through it immediately. He sees all of these things. Now, Wagner does a really clever thing in the dialogue that ensues. Mima is confronting Siegfried, and he's trying to butter him up, or he's trying to lead him one way or another. And what happens is he starts out saying what he wants to say, but by the time he ends each speech, he has spoken out what his real intentions are. And his real intentions are to do Siegfried in and steal the ring away. And this, what I'm trying to get at here, are you familiar with what I call Freudian slips? They're symptomatic actions, where you say something and you're in a state like I'm in right now, rather tired, and you intend to say something, and the subject on which you speak happens to hit on one of your weaknesses or one of the things where you're divided in yourself, and suddenly you blurt something out, and you blurt out what your conscious mind never intended to say at all. And what it is that you have something unconscious, your unconscious desires come out. And the more we are intent on the spirit, the more this happens. And once you have a Freudian slip, everybody knows what you're thinking, because they intuitively see that what you have blurted out wasn't just some simple mistake. It's what you really had inside of you. Now, in some ways, that may sound then that like a person is much more base and much more of a low type of character, but what it really is, when the waking personal self-conscious part of selfhood is relaxed or it can't withstand, then the greater, more unconscious part of self forces all of these things to the surface, so we have to confront them. So it isn't just a statement that we're base, it is that the truth must out, and we have to see what there is no ultimate repression if you're a truth seeker, because the very same thing that leads you to the truth, it brings everything to the surface of yourself, and you have to confront it, even if you do some terribly embarrassing things. And eventually that's what happens. Mima blurts out several times in succession what his real plans are. And of course, Siegfried is repulsed by it all. He's certainly been repulsed by Mima all along. You can't stand yourself for being unregenerate anymore. And so what he does, he just takes the sword and he just slays Mima and won't drink any of the poison of Mima. And that's the end, you might say, the battle, the struggle of self-consciousness with the baser part has been overcome. The sword is obviously the sword of truth. And if you expose to yourself those baser parts of yourself, and then you have a choice of whether you want to act and live on that or not, you certainly don't want to anymore. And when you once know that that's not what you are and that's not what you want, then the battle is over and it's won. As Mima is dying back in the forest, you hear Albrecht laughing, and that's sort of like an echo of the original sin or the original temptation yet to be dealt with. After Mima has been slain, Siegfried takes him to the cave and tosses him in on the pile of gold and tells him that he may rule the horde. And then he takes and pulls the dragon across the front of the cave, and it's thenceforth blocked forever. And then he returns to the linden tree, and it's now past the midday, and he decides to get out of the sun and lay in the shade of the linden tree. And while he's laying there, now that all the excitement is all over again, he feels lonely. And he talks to himself about his loneliness. And this is exactly what we would expect, because we said that initiation can only take place in what is called noon, at least in this true spiritual initiation usually takes place in the time of the day as midnight, but it happens in the noon of evolution. You might say that if spirit, this is going to be one of those terrible types of drawings, but if spirit begins at a high spiritual level and through many kinds of evolutionary spirals, within evolutionary spirals, becomes more and more materialized, when it reaches the height of that materiality, as sort of like the noon, the daytime, the physical, when everything is the most material, and things are about to unspin and return back to the spirit, when things are the outermost, one would expect that this is the time of initiation. And the key to initiation is loneliness. When we were with the Spirit and part of the Spirit with our entire being, even though we weren't completely self-conscious, there was no doubt about our being with God. And the more and more deeply we came into matter, the more we became individualized, the more we became ramified, and the more complex our evolutionary developments became, and the further and further we came from the presence of God, until finally the sexes were separated and we're now very, very much alone. Only now in our loneliness, we must self-consciously say, I'm lonely, and find the divine within ourselves. And when we do that, then loneliness is overcome forever, and we unite with the divine inside of ourselves, and we return as creators instead of as creatures. And all of the differentiations that were made become digested and become regenerated as divine powers within ourselves as we become simpler and simpler and more universal and more spiritual. So this is exactly what happens. The loneliness that is felt right at the nadir, at the depth of materiality, is exactly the same loneliness, if you remember back to the creation myths that we talked about last year. Remember, one of the creation myths was God was lonely. And so he created a daughter for himself, and then he united with his daughter in incest. Meaning to say that the whole of creation was it was a product of loneliness. Once the Supreme Being was differentiated from the Absolute and was self-conscious, that urge for creation was a kind of loneliness, and that same kind of loneliness that made possible the whole creation, it makes possible the fulfillment of that creation in each and every individual as we seek to reunite with God and to come back home and to find that kind of oneness. That is the driving force that brings us back to fulfilling the whole of creation. And so that's what has happened. The bird at this point recognizes his loneliness. And the bird sings to him and tells him that on the top of the mountain is the woman who only a person without fear can awaken, and this is the woman of divine love. And this ends the second act of Siegfried. Now, we said a long time ago that Wagner wrote the words to these operas years before he started writing the music. Now, the break in writing the music, he wrote the music forward from the Rheinmail. So the poetry was written backwards. That is, the Götterdämmerung was written first, and then Siegfried was written, and then the Walküre was written, and then the Das Rheingold was written, all of the words first. And then the music, the motifs were developed, almost every single motif was developed in the Rheingold, and then things came forward with the music until this point, until the beginning of Act 3 of the opera Siegfried. And then, before finishing Act 3, the music of Act 3, Wagner set the whole music aside for 10 years. He set it aside on purpose because he felt he wasn't mature enough yet to write the music for what he wanted to do. Can you imagine that somebody that with that degree of self-consciousness to know about what, you know, that he's still too immature to do this yet? See, because there is between the whole first 2 2/3 operas and even the beginning of the first part of Act 3 of Siegfried, all of the music is down in the low registers. And when Siegfried climbs the mountain to find Brunhilde, everything goes up into the high registers of music, and it becomes very, very celestially beautiful. And when he comes back down in the next opera, back down to earth again, it returns to the low registers. And it's only in this act that everything is supernal, everything is rhapsodic, and everything is in a ringing high register all the way. It's magnificent. But it doesn't begin that way. What happens is, oh, there's a lot of lovely poetry in here, and I want to read some of it. What happens is, at the base of the mountain, there is a cave. And at this cave, the wanderer has reappeared. This is Wotan again, walking among the people of Earth. And he's insecure. This is the union again. Remember, we said before that Wotan, representing heaven, and the airy element united together with Erda, representing the Earth. And out of this union, quite a few beings were born. The Valkyries were born, the Nine Sisters, and out of some of the other unions, some of the descendants, the Volsungs themselves were born. And now Wotan is insecure again, because it's a big moment for Wotan now. And he awakens Erda, and Erda, like all earthy creatures, is a deep, deep sleeper. And she wants to sleep, and she wants to sleep on. And as he's waking her, these are some of the things she sings. The song summons mightily. The spell draws irresistibly. I have been awakened from prescient sleep. Who is it scares away my slumber? Then Wotan announces himself, and then she comes back with these lovely, lovely lines. This is sort of like understanding the earth as the buffer with the absolute, the unconscious manifestation. And this is, you know, the absolute having the unconscious kind of wisdom that is unspeakable. And she says, my sleep is dreaming, my dreaming pondering, my pondering working of wisdom. But while I sleep, the Norns do wake. They twist the rope and docilely spin what I know. Why do you not question the norns? And the norns are the three fates. Remember when we started this year, we started talking about the three old hags in east of the sun and west of the moon. That's the same hags come back now. They're going to be in this play again. What happens is Wotan tells her why he's coming to her. And Erda says, human doings becloud my spirit. A ruler once mastered me, the all-wise one, myself by force. Wotan I bore a wish maiden. He bade her choose heroes for him from the battlefield. She is valiant and wise withal. Why do you awaken me and not ask Erda and Wotan's child for tidings? She's sort of chastising him, saying, I bore you the spirit of truth. Why don't you go ask her, the one that you banished on the rock? She's really giving him the business. And then in her prophetic vision, she really lays it on him. What does she say here? I am confused. Since I awoke, the world revolves tangled and unruly. The Valkyrie, the Wala's child, has been paying the eternal bonds, paying the penalty in bonds of sleep, whilst her prescient mother slept. He who punished defiance does punish defiance. He who kindled the deed is wroth on account of the deed. He who upholds rights and protects oaths now resists the right and reigns by perjury. So she's speaking it's like if she represents the earth, the facts speak in such a way that they don't deliver to you with sauce. They give it to you that this is the facts, and she's prophesying it just like the facts. And she says, let me go again. Let sleep lock my wisdom away. And in another statement, she says to him, you are not what you give yourself out to be. Why have you come, turbulent and headstrong, to disturb Wala's sleep? And she really lays it on him about his living by perjury and himself being affected by the ring. I want to talk about this whole business. Now, Erda represents a prophecy that comes from the Absolute itself. If we think about it, we have an unconscious. And that unconscious part of our being carries both the subconscious, which is our base nature, and it carries the parts of the spirit that we haven't wakened up yet. But in great moments, under the spirit of truth, it gets forced to the surface. And that's just what happened in the great moment for Siegfried. In his desire for the truth, he has forced to the surface, out of the mouth of Mima, all of his own lies and all of his own baser things for them to be slain. Now, all along throughout the operas, we've been seeing that there's been a macrocosmic and a microcosmic parallel. Now, when you have absolutes, when you have upheavals from the absolute, that is the truth of the whole business, the whole shebang. When there are upheavals of that into the world, you know that the world is going to have big things happening. Like, for example, people who have dreams of big volcanoes or things like that. If you have somebody telling you dreams of huge disasters and such like that, that's somebody that's on the edge of flipping out, because they have held in themselves and divided themselves into heaven and earth so much that, and they are not in control of things that now must come out, that they're going to come out with a fury and like rip apart the whole psychic constitution, and the person will be split or schizophrenic. Those kinds of dreams are very often of that, represent that kind of thing happening. So now we're talking about this in the cosmos when there is an upheaval that the almost ever unconscious absolute, as it is rendered into the stuff of earth or matter, which is crystallized ignorance, or that is being taken out of the absolute and becoming spiritual, when you have a big thing like that happening, it's sort of like when the earth starts shaking and it starts throwing up itself, that's when there are going to be big changes. Wotan, on the other hand, even though he has been stung and he's been properly rebuked for his dishonesty and perjury and all of the cunning things he tried to do, he tells her she's not what she imagines herself to be either. He says, a hero who has won the ring and is now a free man, free from fear, and he's filled with love, and he's about to awaken the spirit of truth, and things are going to be altogether different, even though Brunhilde does not understand, even though Erda does not understand, because the unconscious can't understand the things of the conscious, but now that the consciousness has been awakened to its divinity, things are going to happen that the unconscious never ever thought of. And so that there is a different kind of prophecy. There is the prophecy of creative intuition that makes all things new. And he says, go back to sleep. Siegfried approaches with the songbird. And at this point, sassy Siegfried comes back on with the songbird. And the bird, when it sees Wotan, it just flies off. And Siegfried doesn't understand it. And why should the bird be frightened by just this wanderer with the big felt hat, big broad-brimmed felt hat? But this sort of thing often happens. It's like the intuition is lost before the divine. But Siegfried doesn't know this yet. See, because he's still not completely unfolded. The full initiatory drama has not taken place. But he says, all right, I'll go it on my own. I'll go up the mountain. And Wotan does, as he always does, is a mercurial type, and he starts talking. He's a great gabber. And as he does, he starts talking to Siegfried, and he has Siegfried tell his whole story. He's, you know, how he was... how he's seeking a woman who's surrounded by flames, and how he learned about her from the bird song, and how he learned about the bird song from the dragon, and how he learned about how he was led to the dragon by Mima, and how he forged the sword for Mima. It's really interesting. This is retrospection. Before the Hierophant, before the divine, what is happening is Siegfried is singing out his whole history in reverse. It's again a kind of confession. It's a different kind of confession than the type through Mima, which represents blurting out of errors. This is a confession of everything that I have done to the divine. This isn't something that has to be forced out. And he examines Wotan. He looks at everything. He's fearless, and he sees that the guy's got only one eye, and he's unimpressed by him completely, and he confronts him. And Wotan keeps giving broader and broader hints as to who he is, and Siegfried is totally unimpressed. And finally, he just says it out. He says, I am the Lord of the Ravens, which means that he is Wotan, the high god. The ravens are the forethought and afterthought, the Prometheus and Epimetheus of the divine. That which the thought that spins everything forward into material evolution, and the thought that unspins everything in an afterthought back out of material evolution. And Siegfried is still unimpressed, and finally Wotan takes a really strong stance. He says, I am the warder of the rock. And I am the warder of that one that sleeps. And, you know, you're going to be powerless if you try to face me. And obviously, Siegfried is unimpressed. And Wotan tries to stop him. Siegfried tells him he thinks he's just a big boaster. I want to read what transpires here, if I can find it here. And this is when the action starts to take place. Since you do not fear the fire, then let my spear bar your road. My hand still retains its hold of sovereign power. The sword you wield, this shaft once broke into pieces. Once more, then, let it splinter against the everlasting spear. And it comes down with, this is Siegfried's response. My father's foe, do I find you here? How luckily I have chanced upon revenge. Wield your spear. Let my sword splinter it in pieces. This is really interesting. The Freudians, and in a way they would be right, the Freudians would say that Wotan represents the father and the spear represents the father's sexual potency, and that for a young man to actually win a bride for himself, he must overcome the fear of the potency of the father and such like that. And I think that's a valid interpretation. There's nothing invalid about Freud's interpretations, or those of the Freudians in general. It's just that they're limited to only one sphere of activity. I think this is a true thing. We do have to confront the authority not only of our father, but of all of those that have come before us if we're going to come into our own. It's only when we have the confidence in ourselves that we have something new and worthy to give to the world that we can go against the spear of the law, and that everything that is written in the law. So what happens is Siegfried draws his sword, and because he's fearless, and because he's self-reliant, and because he is single-minded, single-purposed, the sword does not shatter for him as it did for his father Sigmund, who divided the spiritual energy and burned the candle at both ends. So what happens is Siegfried shatters the sword, and of course Wotan is sad but overjoyed at the same time. This is really a big moment. This is if you are ready to overcome all of the laws of the world, whether they be legal laws or whether they be customs or even if they're laws of nature. When you come into your divinity, that is, when you are initiated on the path of godhood, you overcome even the laws of nature because you become a free person within those laws, and then those laws are within yourself, and you then are on your own. The gods don't have power over you anymore. You are, in a way, becoming equal with all of the gods. This is where the music gets very, very beautiful. Everything goes up into the high registers as Siegfried comes to the top of the mountain, and he approaches, and there is this ring of fire, and he has no fear of the fire at all. With no hesitancy, he steps right through the fire. On some levels, one could say that it's an etheric fire, as Buddha did in his famous fire sermon, saying that the whole world is on fire. because the whole world is filled with energy. And when one becomes clairvoyant and learns to leave the body and fly up the mountain, so to speak, one passes through that. One could also say that it is the fire of the desire world, that it represents all of the illusions. It's true that when it's talked about the place that is called hell is a place, is a lake of fire, that for people who live in desire, to live completely in desire stuff is a burning when you have desires that can't be satisfied. But on an even deeper level yet, fire has always represented the spirit. And in that, to people who are of an earthly consciousness, of a very human-based consciousness, that is a terrifying thing. Moses, when confronting the burning bush, faced that kind of fire. But when you understand the reality of the fire being the purgatory fire of the spirit that burns up and consumes all of the appearances of the world that have served their purpose to bring about experience as fuel to greater love and light, then it's nothing to penetrate through it, and one revels in the fire. So here he is at this, it's like, you know, if you climb to a very high mountain, the air is thin, and there's a silence because there's nothing up there. All of the things of the earth, all of that busyness is down below. And it's like that. The music is ringing in a quiet, high pitch. And he sees a horse and a warrior laying down. And he's led on to that. Let's see. These are some of his words. Ha! A man in arms. How the sight of him does urge me on. Does the helmet perhaps press upon his glorious brow? It would be easier for him were I to loosen his accoutrement. Oh, how lovely! Shimmering clouds, rippling border, the bright celestial lake, the smiling image of a radiant sun beams through a billowing mass of clouds. With swelling breath the bosom heaves. Shall I undo the tight coat of mail? Come, my sword, cut through the iron. And so he removes the breastplate from the warrior, and he's astounded to find out that it is a woman. In fact, for some people, when you hear the opera, they laugh, because what he says, Bach, that is kein Mann, meaning to say, that's no man. And people laugh at that. But that's intended, because it's a great shock to us when we see ourselves in the inner opposite, and the reflection of our divine nature is of the opposite gender. And so the hero sees the spirit as represented as a woman, and it astounds him. And he's reminded of his mother. Remember, all along, he's never seen his mother. He was born an orphan. His mother died on giving birth to him. He never has seen his father. And so he's always been seeking the mother. This is, again, the absolute in another sense, looking for that feminine truth that always leads us on. And then something else happened. How shall I awaken the maid, that she may open her eyes for me, open her eyes to me? Would their gaze not blind me through? Would I dare to risk it? Could I endure their light? A buzzing in my ears, everything swims. Before my eyes, my head is in a whirl. Searing longing consumes my senses. My hand trembles upon my timorous heart. How is it with me, coward? Is this then fearing? O mother, mother, you fearless child, a woman lies asleep. She has taught him to fear. How shall I put an end to the fear. How shall I summon up courage? In order to wake myself, I must awaken the maid. Her flower-like mouth quivers invitingly. How sweetly it arouses my fear, its quivering. Oh, the fragrance deliciously warm of that breath. Awake, awake, holiest of women. Clearly, when he never knew fear before, which is as it should be, all of the things of the world are the appearances. They're only separate things. They're not the divine and holy truth. Now, when the self sees the higher part of its being, the spiritual self, and is in awe before the beauty of its divinity, fear is learned. But it's not the kind of fear that makes him a wimp or anything like that. It's the kind of fear that is more an awe than it is fear. It has awakening in him relative to the self-conscious part of his being. He's aware of his limitation, of his insignificance before the grandeur of the divine. And before that, he is awed and he is fear-struck. And then he goes on to say, she hears me not. Then must I suck life from those sweetest of lips, though I should pass away dying withal. And then he kisses her. This is the beginning of the divine union. The waking consciousness now has seen through its base nature and is now beginning to awaken to its divine nature. An artist couldn't find a better symbol to represent the beginning of that union than a kiss. It's a very intimate, a very gentle, but a very significant union between the higher and the lower fusing into the waking self-consciousness. It's only a kiss because he's not a full-fledged God yet, but he has only now just begun to awaken to his divine nature. And in doing that, it's sort of that shivering kind of experience. And what happens is when he kisses her, she awakens. This is really now an intuition of a very thorough nature. It's not an intuition, it's something that just comes flying into you. This is an awareness of a union within self with something divine. Brunhilde, oh, wakes up singing, "Hail to thee, O sun. Hail to thee, light. Hail to thee, shining day. Long was my sleep. I have been awoken. Who is the hero who has awakened me?" You see, even though both the personality in the reflective projection has been developing for ages in the whole evolutionary process, and in reflection, but not in complete indwelling union, the spirit has also been becoming. When they come together in that first kiss, they are both intimates, having known each other for a long, long time, but they're both strangers to each other. The spirit, the ways of the world and the ways of humans are strange to the spirit, just as the spirit is strange to the human consciousness. And that's exactly what it's like. What happens here from now until the end of the opera is probably one of the most beautiful love duets in all opera, because it's not just "I love you, baby, let's go to bed with each other and it'll be a glorious thing." This is the beginning of a completely clear and penetrating dialogue. Before, it was question and answer in the Hermetic dialogue when Siegfried is questioning his lower self, or when the Hierophant, the Wanderer, is questioning Mima, or when the Wanderer questions Siegfried and he confesses his whole past history, and from that garners up the strength in the spirit to overcome Wotan. Now the conversation is a union. It's talking to yourself, or yourself talking to you, because you're both one at this point. It's hard to say which is which. Talking as one has always wanted to talk. It is a divine consolation, as it is, for example, in the writings of Thomas a Kempis. Or it is a divine dialogue where all of the questions we've ever had, all of the seekings we've ever wanted, are capable of being answered. And where the sleeping spirit of truth can now, without reserve, give itself to the questioner. Because here is somebody who is worthy of those answers, who has proven himself to be true and to be a real votary of the truth. And so it's as beautiful of a discourse as you can possibly have. He hearkens back to his mother, and she comes on telling her side, "You child of delight, your mother will never return to you more. Your own self am I. If you do but love me, fortunate maid, what you do not know, I know for you. Yet I am wise only because I love you. O Siegfried, Siegfried, victorious light, I have always loved you, for by me alone was Wotan's thought and intention divined. The thought I might never name, which I did not think, but merely felt, for which I have fought, struggled, and strove, for which I defied him who had conceived it, for which I was making atonement, punishment bound me because I could not think it and only felt. For the thought, you might guess it, was only my love for you." In a way, it sounds like going back to Platonism again, because it is being bound to the personality, which in some ways is unpleasant, but she is finally completing the thought. She's finally completing the intention of the divine. And that's what we are. If we're wise enough and humble enough to listen and to strive and fulfill, we find we have this very, very special divine purpose. And in that moment of our beginning of the union with the divine tells us of our special place. We all have a purpose. We all have a meaning. The whole universe is born in us. He knows now in a way that he could never know before that he is a redeemer of the whole world, because now he has begun to unfold as a creator the entire creation. And the spirit that was the intent of the divine all along to make something that could create and could create new and free so that Wotan, the creator, could be freed from its own past, which could only be done by something completely new, completely free, that has now been accomplished, because Wotan couldn't do that by himself alone. He could have that wish for something like that, but he couldn't do it because he was the product of the past. And now is fulfilled that thought. It's brought to completion. And this is not a vain statement, but when we become in our spiritual natures, we are a tremendous, tremendous service to God. It's, you know, we are what we were, what we're supposed to be. Siegfried, at this point, is totally enraptured by her, and he describes that he loses all of his senses. What do you expect with a transcendental experience? You're completely removed from your body and you're awakened beyond the mind, and that's just exactly what you would expect, is that you would lose your senses. There's some more beautiful poetry in here. Thrice blessed maid has wounded my heart. A woman has dealt me wounds in the head, which I came with neither shield nor helm. It's a really interesting passage. This is literally a taking from the ancient mysteries, because all of the mysteries of the Western world are called Hermetic, of Hermes, which is one of the Greek names for Wotan. And the threefold spirit that became manifest in those mysteries was called thrice blessed. He states his fear, and she states her vulnerability. And this union that is now beginning to be forged, this binding that is taking place, he has this fear or awe or reverence or something like that, and the spirit recognizes its vulnerability, and it's going to be exposed to a very, very harsh world in the personality. This union is exceptionally powerful. It's exceptionally powerful because it's based on the subtlest and the most gentle and the most rare parts of both the personality and the individuality. When we get on the spiritual path, we don't look for things like we find in science fiction, these wapple, zapple, great miraculous experiences. We look for something much, much more subtle. And the more subtle we become, the more powerful the experiences become. But he still doesn't know how to relate to this yet, so he starts kissing her impetuously, and she repulses him. And she's a little bit upset by the whole business, because she says, "He has broken my breastplate and helm. I am Brunhilde no more," meaning to say she is not protected by a divine aloofness hidden from by a curtain of illusion. She realizes that now she can't be herself in the way she was before, and she's extremely, extremely vulnerable. He asks her to be a woman to him. She doesn't understand it. She begins to lose her vision. She begins to, become taken aback by the whole situation. You see, this moment is a very long moment, even though it seems to take just a little bit. But when the personality and the individuality become one, there is a whole adjustment. And the point of view of each is, clearly, Siegfried is still a sassy little boy. And clearly, she is a very, very vulnerable maiden. And at first, she sees her whole position as a position of shame, because she is aware of herself now with the kind of objectivity that we have in the physical body. And when we first had the awareness of our physical body, we were innocent like Brunhilde was. This is why in the story of Adam and Eve, there was a shame of their body because it was such a limitation relative to the divine consciousness. And the whole notion is, remember when we talked about the Platonists last year, that for them coming into this realm was dying, and this physical body was a sarcophagus. And from the viewpoint of the spirit, it seems that way. He says to her, if you only loved me, or if only you loved me. And that's the weakness of the personality. We always doubt whether we're loved. And at this point, even with the union with the divine, getting used to it, it still does, in the same way, didn't realize the power of the Tarnhelm of the ring. He doesn't realize what he has here yet either, because he doesn't realize that he's loved yet. And he prods her imploringly. We still have to court the spirit, even when we're beginning to come at one with it. And he bids her, awake to your nature and be mine. It's probably a projection. Probably what's happening there is she'd like him to awaken to her nature and wake up. She in turn says to him, I've always been yours. He takes her in his arms and he tries to hold her even tighter, and she tells him how her spiritual peace and calm is turning to passion. Is he not afraid? Now this is really, really remarkable. The experience of peace is not something that is soporific. It's not a sleepy experience. It's not just a placid, calm laying there. The experience of peace is tremendously exciting. And what is being described here is that peace is becoming manifest in the personality. It's described here as desire, but we know from the mysteries as we looked last year, it's enthusiasm. The spirit being born or coming now into the personality is this divine enthusiasm that just radiates. And she wonders if he's still afraid, and he says he's forgotten fear. He's sort of gone back to becoming very bold again. She says she must love and bind and perish with him in laughter. She knows the whole of it. She knows that when the spirit enters into the body, that the power of that is going to eventually break it down, because everything is now going to be dissolved and it's going to go back into the spirit. She also knows about the ring, and she knows that that they're going to perish with that. But the lines that are in here that are so beautiful, she must merge with him in laughter. The experience, I believe one can laugh oneself into enlightenment. Meaning to say, when the personality has insecurity and the intuition frees that insecurity, then one relaxes. And then more of the flow of the spirit comes in, and one relaxes more. And things that we've had anxieties about, when we have those anxieties removed, the feeling is a feeling of laughter. We always laugh when somebody else got the pie in the face and it didn't hurt them. And when our insecurities are relieved and we are united, and the echo or the reverberation coming from the spirit is also laughter, knowing that it is being understood and that it is being appreciated. And so it's a really joyous kind of thing. So even though there is at the same time this prophetic understanding of the doom that's going to come about as the part of this union, because it is the beginning of the fulfillment of the whole creation, the spirit is now united in and with matter and with the personality, which is so that all of the unknown that is in matter and in the personality can now be taken into the spirit, and the general insecurity of the supreme being in the whole creation is now being fulfilled in this same kind of union. And in that same union activity, it means the downfall. The cosmos isn't going to exist if it doesn't need to exist. And this creative work, the beginning of the end, has come. What happens is let's try to read it here. Singing together, first she sings, "Twilight of the gods, come, darken above, night of annihilation, come down in mist." And what's happening at this part is they're both giving themselves over to each other, and she pledges love and bliss, which is what the spirit gives to us, and he pledges light, which is what he is feeding to the spirit from the experience. And they accept the annihilation, and they pledge their troth and their trust to each other forever. This is the divine marriage. This is the alchemical marriage that transforms both the spirit and the personality into something wondrous. So that which could be becomes that which is, and that which is finds its fulfillment in potentiality. And this is a union. This is the marriage that we have all always sought for. This is the partner that can never fail us. This is the vow, the only one vow, the one pledge that we can make that lasts forever. And so they make this view, and the spirit and the personality, which become one something else, this is not just some little trice. This is a divine union, and it even is a union that goes all the way into the macrocosm, because the spirit is in extent at the limits of the macrocosm. So we see what's going on. We see the ring is now beginning to go. It's past its halfway point in its revolution, and it's starting to turn back. And since we've been looking at heroes all year, we probably have the best rendition in mythology, given in an artistic manner, of the becoming of a hero, and the prize won that all heroes strive for. That is the divine union. Now we have to look a little bit into the downfall and the destruction. We'll look into the near history when we look at the last opera, the Gotterdammerung, which is just as tough as the words sound. And next week we'll start with that, and it'll probably take us 2 weeks. We've now had our time at the top of the mountain, and it's time to go back to the world again. And I thank you very much for listening to this. It's hard for me even to talk about these things, but this is, to me, one of the experiencing of what is in this opera, to hear it in the music and to feel it in the spirit, is one of the most wonderful things in life for me. And so we can carry on with what the hero does next time.